This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, Rami Al-Megari reports from Gaza City on Valentine's Day as people celebrate their loved ones despite scarce commodities.
At this well-known store in Gaza City, customers, mainly young men and women, are buying gifts and flowers to exchange with their relatives, friends and those they love.
Also, Palestinians fight to stay on reclaimed Ain Hijla land in the Jordan Valley. Lema Nazih of the Popular Struggle Coordination Committee joins us to talk about being evicted by Israeli forces, but returning the next day.
The Israeli forces came, and actually there were like 15 jeeps of the Israelis came, and the special forces came, and they start to evict us again without even talking with us or even seeing the papers.
Sarah Irving speaks with Uri Gordon, editor of a new book, Anarchists Against the Wall, Direct Action and Solidarity with the Palestinian Popular Struggle. And she also reviews the documentary The Do-Gooders, a confused and contradictory film on how foreigners, quote, help Palestine. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, associate editor for the Electronic Intifada in Oakland. Many Palestinians in Gaza celebrate Valentine's Day, a Western tradition exchanging gifts and celebrating romance. This year's Valentine's Day comes as the Israeli blockade on Gaza has remained in place for 7 years, and as hundreds of underground tunnels for smuggling essential supplies into Gaza have been destroyed. The Electronic Intifada's Rami Al-Megari has more.
At this well-known store in Gaza City, customers, mainly young men and women, are buying gifts and flowers to exchange with their relatives, friends and those they love. The activity at the Ambassador of Love store has been repeated every year on Valentine's Day for the past 14 years. Nida is a 20-year-old woman and university student from Gaza City. She is here to mark Valentine's Day.
I'm going to buy some chocolates for my family, my brothers, and my parents.
The owner of the store, Wasim Abdo, says that this year's celebration is a bit different from previous years in terms of the availability of goods he sells.
We've been working very hard, but the business has slowed down compared with past years, according to the needs of our customers. A few days ago, some religious preachers came to my store and started preaching to me against Valentine's Day celebrations, saying it was prohibited from a religious point of view.
However, Abdu adds that since the Hamas party took political control of the coastal territory in 2007, his business has not been interrupted. Since 2007, Israel has enforced an economic blockade on Gaza, and the store's owners like Wasim Abdu have relied on underground smuggling tunnels between Egypt and Gaza. Since June of last year, Egyptian authorities have shut down the majority of those tunnels, making many essential goods and commodities scarce. Rami Al-Megari for the Electronic Intifada, Gaza.
As our contributor Patrick O'Strickland reported for us last week, Palestinian activists reclaimed the ancient village of Ain Hijla in the Jordan Valley on January 31st and maintained a presence on the land for a week before being violently evicted by Israeli occupation forces on January 7th. The action aimed to confront and reject the ongoing militarization and confiscation of Palestinian land in the Jordan Valley by Israeli settlements and the army. Activists returned to the village over the past week, and some were arrested by Israeli forces. The Popular Struggle Coordination Committee stated on Wednesday that, quote, about 9 activists from Ain Hijla in the Jordan Valley have been evicted again after their return to the village. The popular resistance activists have returned to check up on the village and stay when Israeli forces raided it and showed a military order declaring the village a closed military zone for 1 month. 2 Palestinian activists, Mahmoud Zawahri and Mundhar Amira, have been arrested. Both were taken to a detention center before they were released on bail. Israeli forces informed both arrestees that they are not allowed to return to the area or visit it for 2 months. Those who returned and were evicted on Wednesday were aiming to stay in the village and call upon the rest of Palestinians to return. Israeli forces threatened the activists who had a document signed by Deir Hijla Monastery allowing them to use their land. Nevertheless, Israeli forces ignored the document and forced the Palestinians out of the village, declaring it a closed military zone and threatening to arrest any Palestinian that comes onto the village land. Joining us on Thursday to talk about the reclamation of Ain Hijleh and the current situation as Palestinians continue to resist Israeli attempts to evict them from this land was Lema Nazih. Lema is on the board of directors of the Popular Struggle Coordination Committee and joined us from Ramallah. I asked her to begin by talking about the last 2 days in Ain Hijleh after the village was raided by Israeli forces on Wednesday. Lema was one of the activists who were forcibly evicted from Ain Hijleh.
Yesterday we went, 9 people of the Popular Struggle Coordination Committee, to go back to Ain Hijleh after we took paper from the church that we allowed to use the land for 2 months. And when we arrived there, we actually arrived there and we set the bonfire and we started to work on the village 15 minutes and the Israeli forces came. And actually there were like 15 jeeps of the Israelis came and the special forces came and they start to evict us again without even talking with us or even seeing the papers. And after that, they took right away three of the activists. They took them in, aside, and we are the rest. They put us in detained. Then after that, they released one, and they decided to take two of the activists, which is Mahmoud Zawahri and Munir Amir. And we stayed for like 2 hours in Ain Hijleh. They're asking us questions. They confiscated my phone. And they took all of our IDs. And after that, they told us to go back. And it's a military zone for like 1 month.
And what's the current situation today after that sweeping arrest raid yesterday?
Now we are the lawyer of the Popular Struggle Coordination Committee trying to activate the paper that we have that we can use the land for 2 months. So now we're waiting for the court decision to cancel the military order.
Can you talk about how determined the community of activists are in trying to reclaim this land and maintain a presence on it right now?
Actually, the Jordan Valley, all of the Jordan Valley is one of our targets because it's now on the negotiation table and there are much of speaking about it and argument to take it. And for that reason, we as Palestinians reclaiming it as a Palestinian part of the Palestinian land, and we're not going to lose it, especially that there is like water resources and it's a Palestinian land and owner of the private Palestinians. So of course we're going to reclaim it and we're not going to just turn our back for it.
Lema, can you talk about what the plans are if this military order is overturned? What are the plans that activists have for this village and especially as a symbol of resistance for other places inside the occupied West Bank and inside historic Palestine in terms of reclaiming Palestinian heritage and land?
Actually, this is actually two double standards because we're trying to push the Palestinian Authority to not let the Jordan Valley go in the negotiation. So we're making this one pressure, and the other pressure is on the Israeli forces that they cannot take it. So we're trying to do the to push the Palestinian Authority and the Israelis. And of course, for that, we're going to go back each time to reclaim it, and we're not going to give up on the Jordan Valley. This is for sure.
Lema, can you talk a little bit more about the current situation inside the Jordan Valley right now? Palestinian villages, Bedouin communities are being demolished on a regular basis. What does the Jordan Valley look like right now?
For example, yesterday when I went back to Ain Hijleh, it was a really sad view to see. And it felt really like there was people living here and they were out, forcibly out. And every time we hear a new village in the Jordan Valley, new orders of to destroy houses, to confiscate more land. And the situation there is really dangerous. And we know that, and I think everyone knows that it's really dangerous. And I think the Jordan Valley must be one of the main topics now.
Lema, if people want to know more about the work of the Popular Struggle Coordination Committee and get regular updates, how can they do that?
We have the Facebook page and the Twitter account, and they can follow all the events, all the actions we do, and even the press releases that we release.
Great. Lama Nasih, thank you so much. You are on the board of directors of the Popular Struggle Coordination Committee, and you're one of the many activists involved in the struggle to reclaim Ain Hijle in the Jordan Valley. Thank you so much for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you, Noura. Thank you so much.
Up next, the Electronic Intifada's contributor Sarah Irving recently reviewed the new book about the Israeli direct action collective Anarchists Against the Wall. The eponymous book was just published by AK Press. She interviewed Uri Gordon, a member of the group and the editor of the book. Here's Sarah Irving.
You are obviously one of the editors of a new book out with AK Press that is a compilation of pre-existing and, I believe, newly commissioned writings from people involved with Anarchists Against the Wall. Can you give me a little bit of a background to the book?
Well, the book was an initiative that came out of the Institute for Anarchist Studies in New York, and they are publishing a series of books called Anarchist Interventions, which are kind of supposed to be relatively short. They kind of approached the group to do a book with them, and I became involved, and we took materials that had appeared in a previous kind of fanzine that the group had made back in 2007, I believe. And then we also asked people to write new pieces. And so the book has essentially two main parts. The first is a collection of statements and speeches given by members of the group over the years, mostly kind of things that were issued in the early days of the group, calls to action and leaflets and things like that. And the second part is slightly longer essays and reflections that address a real wide range of topics, like the politics of solidarity and negotiating privilege and internal dynamics and how we relate to friends and family who do not share our views. So all of these kind of topics, relationship with the media, emotional first aid and dealing with post-trauma. And also just a lot of, just personal stories and experiences that are told in there.
One of the things that very much came out of the book for me was that there was a real stress from a lot of both the kind of official, in inverted commas, statements, but also from a lot of the personal statements that Anarchists Against the Wall very much respects the idea that the primary issue here is a Palestinian one. It's about Palestinian leadership, and that Israeli activists really very much have to respect that and to be allies. How do you see that as differing from the mainstream Israeli peace movement?
I think the difference is probably that, the mainstream Israeli peace movement does what it does without much contact with Palestinians. There is almost this kind of perception of two separate societies, or as if the West Bank and Gaza is somehow like a different country that already has its borders that is under the occupation, and therefore things should happen distinctly on each side. I think that part of the contribution of Anarchists Against the Wall was to really change the default understanding of what resisting the occupation means, and the kind of actions like, you know, demonstrations inside Israel, or petitions, or interfaith dialogue, or all these things which were in the repertoire of the mainstream left until then, have been now supplanted with the idea of a joint struggle, with the idea of Israelis coming to give solidarity on the ground where they're invited by a grassroots Palestinian initiatives, whether that's for demonstrations in the West Bank or to accompany olive harvesting or to kind of just be there when there are attacks by settlers or the army, you know, to try to resist housing demolitions. All of these things are now, I think, understood to be what it means to be truly against the occupation. And we also have to remember that, you know, this kind of mainstream Israeli peace movement has basically fizzled out, over the last 10 years or more. And there is today very little that is heard from, you know, groups like Peace Now, for example. What they do is mainly, you know, they have a kind of settlement monitoring project where they monitor the growth of the settlements in the West Bank and every new outpost and so on, which I think is, you know, is useful work. They don't really organize kind of mass demonstrations anymore or any of that. And similar with others. And, you know, I think that basically as the mainstream of Israeli society just shifted to the right in one block, the parts of the left, of the far left, who had stayed where they are, also realized the reasons why things like the Oslo process had failed, and therefore what remains of a peace movement, or more like, you know, an anti-colonial movement in the Jewish Israeli public, is, I think, much more radical today, and has defined the fault lines of politics in Israel in a new way.
In terms of dynamics within Israel now, we've been hearing a lot over the last year or two, maybe, of serious problems with racism, not just against Palestinians, but also against refugees from North Africa and sub-Saharan Africa and from other places. How much do people like those who've been involved in Anarchists Against the Wall kind of try and draw together those kind of struggles and the ongoing issue of the occupation?
Sure. Well, it's, you know, the radical left in Israel is so small that it's basically the same group of however many dozens of people who are doing everything that Israelis are doing in those various issues. So, you know, people who are on a Friday with the Anarchists Against the Wall hat going to demonstrate in the West Bank, then, you know, 2 days later with the Resistance to the Power Plan hat going to, participate in, resistance to the dispossession and ethnic cleansing of Bedouin, citizens, right, in the South. And then another day they are, you know, in South Tel Aviv, working together with refugees, or trying to resist, right-wing provocations by, you know, even members of parliament coming to raise hatred towards refugees from Eritrea or Sudan in Tel Aviv. So essentially, it's, you know, I think it's these things are absolutely linked, not just in theory, but also because it's like the same handful of people who are taking action on all of these issues.
When you talk about the numbers as being that small in terms of Israel's activist community, how much space would you say there is in society, and how much of a hope do you think can actually be carried by such a small movement?
Not a lot. And I think, you know, many of the participants in Anarchists Against the Wall, and this is something that comes through in the book, are acting despite a lot of despair and cynicism about where things can go. And this kind of, you know, it's a kind of fatalism that you also hear a lot, you know, from the Palestinian counterparts. I think that it's important to do, no matter how effective it turns out to be in the long run. I think as well, though, that it really can't be left to the small Israeli radical community to do this on its own, and that is why there have been increasing calls for supporting boycott, sanctions, and divestment coming from outside the country. And I think that this combination of international pressure and Palestinian popular struggle with Israeli accompaniment is basically the only kind of method that we really have in order to try and generate some shift in the politics on the ground. I don't think that, you know, a resolution of the conflict is around the corner. I don't think that the occupation will end tomorrow. But I also don't think that things can stay as entrenched as they are for much longer. This kind of the current creeping annexation and is a real pressure cooker. Now, the way out of it in the immediate term, or the way that pressure is released, may not be necessarily a positive, right? It may take the shape of another kind of large scale confrontation. But something is going to shift in the coming years, one way or another.
That was Uri Gordon of Anarchists Against the Wall, interviewed by the Electronic Intifada's contributor, Sarah Irving. And finally, Sarah Irving reviewed a new documentary film, The Do-Gooders, about international human rights workers in Palestine. Here she is.
In the opening moments of Do-Gooders, Chloe Ruthven declares that as a child, she hated the Palestinians, which is a strong statement to make, especially against a backdrop of newsreel from the Nakba. Her emotion was, I guess, the reaction of a child who probably idolised her grandmother and would have liked more of her attention. Instead, Pamela Cooper was working in refugee camps across the Middle East and establishing the charity Medical Aid for Palestinians. I want to preface this review by saying that I really wanted to like this film. It raises some important issues, and it tries to do so in a personalised way that should make that more approachable. But the unfortunate result of Ruthven's personal journey in this movie is a confused narrative with different strands that bump uncomfortably up against one another. As I said, there are some important points made, mostly by Lubna Massawa and other Palestinian speakers in the film. But sadly, they're often lost amid a lack of context and sometimes contradictory messages. The first half hour of Do-Gooders focuses on volunteers and solidarity activists in the West Bank and Gaza. We witness meetings at Project Hope in Nablus, the opening of Cinema Jenin, human rights observers, and a demonstration against the siege in Gaza. In this section, Ruthven's voiceover raises some significant issues. Yes, an increasing number of Palestinian and non-Palestinian voices are questioning the way in which the West Bank has become the latest fashionable place for Western 20-somethings to spend a summer helping, in inverted commas, those less fortunate than themselves. Yes, there are also deep ethical questions about why a seemingly unqualified, unaffiliated international is seen interviewing, again in inverted commas, a victim of Israeli human rights abuses, especially when that victim is a sobbing minor unaccompanied by a parent or a guardian who seems to have just been released from detention to an empty home which has been trashed by Israeli soldiers. Some of the volunteers we see are indeed patronising, uncomprehending of the values and norms around them. But the film's narrative never seems to grapple with exactly what is wrong with the situation. We hear that Ruthven is uneasy or uncomfortable, but there's no coherent critique. Sometimes the link between Ruthven's narrative and the action on screen is fairly hazy. When she heads to Gaza, for instance, she tells us that only, quote, serious aid professionals can get in. But then she spends her time with activists from the International Solidarity Movement, which is hardly the UN. Part of this incoherence seems to come from Ruthven's own lack of knowledge. At the start of the journey, she films her Lonely Planet guidebook and her grandmother's autobiography and admits that she's surprised that she's not seeing refugee camps that look like the Nakba photos that she's seen. Of Ramallah, she expected tanks, but finds instead a five-star hotel. It's a valid description of the Ramallah bubble, but we get no information as to how concentrations of aid money and credit have created this weird economic and social anomaly. There is also, one senses, a slight disappointment that Ruthven hasn't found a crisis. I couldn't see what Fassbinder had to do with the people of Jenin, she comments when she finds the cinematic library there. Perhaps art house movies aren't top priority, but why shouldn't Palestinians have just as much access to global culture as anyone anywhere else? It's therefore a breath of fresh air to hear Lubna Musawwar's cogent critiques. As she emphasises, there are deep problems with some international involvement in Palestine, when foreign activists dictate agendas and enforce discourses of non-violence, in inverted commas again, which deny Palestinian ownership of their own struggle. Why aren't these activists, she demands, demonstrating at home, resisting their own governments, instead of coming to a place where they don't understand the issues or the language? Masarwa's prominence in the film coincides with a shift in focus to the multi-billion dollar world of USAID and EU funding, rather than solidarity activists and volunteers. Although Ruthven doesn't seem to articulate how she sees the two as being linked, if indeed she does, and again, that's not clear either. Ruthven is whisked off with her own private PR woman and a jeep with tinted windows, as she puts it, to visit USAID programs. The water projects cost US taxpayers $45 million a time. Yet, says the off-script engineer to alarm from the PR woman, USAID is fully aware that restrictions on Palestinian water use enforced under the Oslo Accords render the expensive pumps that they're paying for useless. In the Jordan Valley, meanwhile, a shepherd named Abu Sakr makes the most telling statement of the entire film. I don't want World Food Programme flour and lentils, he said. I want the international community to pressure Israel so that I can use my own resources on my own land. Ruthven's naivety is a major aspect of her narrative device, but as she's the film's main voice, it also means that the conclusions are frustratingly naive and simplistic. I had no idea how dependent the Palestinian economy was on aid, she says. The obvious question is why, when she's making a documentary on aid in Palestine, she hasn't done her homework. She draws dichotomies between aid and political action, without clarifying who she sees as being guilty of separating the two. But later she says that she's learned that the people at the top can't change anything, which seems to contradict her earlier call for political rather than humanitarian action. She also says, I was beginning to feel frustrated about how stuck it all seemed. What the fuck is all this non-violent resistance? Just get violent. In saying that, she's guilty of the same agenda dictating she earlier criticised, as well as ignoring the dangers that Palestinians have to weigh up when they select their tactics. As often with critical narratives, the final problem is that she suggests no answers. We get a brief view of the work of Dahlia, a community-based organisation, which she holds up because of its independent stance and refusal of funding which comes with strings attached. But we don't get a clear idea of how common this pattern is, and we don't get a wider context, because Dahlia is not the only organisation which has boycotted conditional funding and has made really tough decisions through having to do that. It's depressingly typical of this film that it ends not by grappling with the moral and political bankruptcy of Western aid, but with a passing thought from Ruthven on what her grandparents might have said, followed by a day on the beach at Jaffa.
And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis by our team of correspondents and bloggers, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.